Welcome to Ekatra Dialogue, a journey through timeless literature. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekatra AI.
Welcome back. So today we're diving into Eleanor Catton's 2023 novel, Birnam Wood. It's a fascinating book, I think. Feels less like typical fiction and maybe more like a kind of unsettling roadmap for modern activism. It really sets up this immediate clash, doesn't it, between these big utopian ideals and just, well, brutal financial reality.
Absolutely. And it's the kind of work that really cements Catton's place.
Yeah.
You know, as one of our most significant contemporary writers, people often call her a literary architect.
Yeah, I've heard that.
Because she builds these incredibly complex, almost clockwork-like novels. Remember, she was the youngest ever Booker Prize winner for The Luminaries back in 2013. Just showed such intellectual power.
Great. But what really strikes me about Birnam Wood is the shift in genre. It's quite a pivot.
It really is.
She goes from that historical sweep of the gold rush in The Luminaries to something incredibly sharp, very immediate, a contemporary eco-thriller, but also a social satire. She's taking that same kind of structural ambition, that complexity, and applying it to, well, the really urgent stuff of today. Mm-hmm. Climate crisis, wealth inequality, the limits of political idealism.
And the collision she sets up is just devastatingly simple, isn't it? You have this grassroots anti-capitalist group, the Birnam Wood Collective, and they run right up against the seductive, corrupting power of modern wealth. Limitless power, really, personified by this American tech billionaire, Robert Lemoyne. And the question she forces you, the reader, to confront is just agonizing. If you're an activist, what do you do? What happens when the very system you're fighting offers you exactly what you need to make your dream happen?
It's that ultimate test, isn't it? Integrity versus expediency, getting things done. Okay, so let's unpack that setup. Tell us about Birnam Wood at the start. What state are they in?
Okay, so the setting is crucial. New Zealand's remote South Island, very isolated. Birnam Wood itself is a guerrilla gardening collective. So they plant crops illegally, basically, on neglected land, public land, wherever they can find a patch. But when the novel opens, they're really on the verge of collapse.
Right.
They're broke. They're completely exhausted. There are internal splits after years of really thankless hard work. They desperately need land. They need money. They need something to pull them together.
And their desperation kind of runs headlong into a disaster. The thing that kicks it all off isn't human. It's environmental. A huge landslide cuts off the Coraway Pass.
Exactly. And it isolates this massive farm owned by Sir Owen Darvish, completely cuts it off.
And Catton uses that landslide so effectively. It's not just, you know, a way to move the plot forward.
Not at all. It's definitely a symbol for the wider environmental crisis, sure.
Mm-hmm.
But practically, it creates what you could call a temporary autonomous zone. Yeah. Suddenly, the usual rules law, property rights are suspended. It creates this perfect vacuum for moral choices.
Yeah.
Good ones and, well, terrible ones.
A moral laboratory.
Yeah.
And into this zone walks Mira Bunting. She's the founder of the collective. Charismatic, maybe a little bit reckless.
Definitely driven.
She trespasses onto this isolated farm, scouting it, seeing it as this last desperate chance for the collective to actually survive, to get some land. But instead of finding the elderly landowner she expects, she finds Lemoyne.
And that meeting, that's the absolute core of the book. Lemoyne, this enigmatic American tech billionaire. He shows up with this unsettling kind of charm and almost immediately offers them salvation. $100,000 in funding.
Wow.
It's the classic Faustian bargain, right?
Yeah.
But completely updated for the 21st century.
And the price, what's the catch?
The catch is they have to operate on the farm, look like a legitimate group, and basically act as a, what does the book call it? A plausible earthy cover story for whatever Lemoyne is doing there. He claims he's building an apocalypse-proof bunker.
Right. Plausible enough, maybe, given the character.
Plausible enough. And Mira, desperate to save the collective, agrees. But here's the crucial mistake, the fatal flaw. She keeps the full truth secret, the compromised nature of this deal. She hides it from everyone else in Birnam Wood.
Yeah, that secrecy is key.
It's almost sickeningly simple, the mechanism of corruption here. It's not some grand evil act she has to perform. It's just silence and accepting convenience.
So once that deal is struck, things seem to slow down a bit, action-wise. The focus shifts, it becomes more about the characters, the internal strain. It's described as being about the gradual erosion of certainty, and that feels right. The money comes in, solves some problems, sure, but immediately introduces this poison of distrust.
And Mira's journey is just heartbreaking. Because you get what she does it initially. She starts out as this idealistic leader, convinced she can handle Lemoyne, maybe even outsmart him. But she gets seduced pretty quickly by the sheer power his money gives her. the ability to finally get things done efficiently.
Yeah, that efficiency must be tempting.
Totally. So she starts rationalizing lies, one after another, telling herself the ends this sustainable farm justify the means being lying to her closest friends and taking dirty money. She crosses these moral lines, barely even seeming to notice them until it's far, far too late.
And then, as a contrast to Mira, you have Shelley Noakes.
Yes, Shelley. Yeah. She's sort of the weary moral compass, the disillusioned pragmatist. She already had doubts about Mira's leadership before Lemoyne showed up. So her story's about finding her own way, gaining moral clarity outside Mira's influence. While Mira is kind of spiraling, Shelley becomes more and more skeptical about Lemoyne. She wants the project, the farm, to work, but she sees how toxic his presence is.
Okay, so you have Mira compromising, Shelley pulling back, and then there's Tony Gallo, the third point in this triangle.
Oh, Tony.
Yeah.
He's the ideological purist. The source material calls him that. And it fits perfectly. He actually left Burnham Wood already because he felt they weren't radical enough.
Right.
Not really challenging the system. So when he hears about this deal with a billionaire, for him, it's the ultimate betrayal. It's the absolute definition of selling out.
He seems to operate in a very black and white world. Compromise is just collaboration with the enemy.
Exactly. No gray areas for Tony. So he becomes this kind of Cassandra figure in the novel. He's shouting the uncomfortable truth that their deal is complicity, but nobody wants to listen. Not really. Not until it's way too late. His decision to leave, but then to become obsessed with exposing the deal, it kind of forces him into being this agent of chaos, almost. Tragic chaos.
But the real engine of the plot, the antagonist, is Robert Lemoyne. And he's terrifying precisely because he isn't some, you know, cartoon villain.
Not at all. He's described as a chilling embodiment of 21st century surveillance capitalism. And that feels spot on. He's almost like a force of nature in the book. Static, in a way.
Mm-hmm.
His motivation is just profit and power. Completely unconstrained by ethics, by law. He doesn't need to change or develop because he's already rigged the game.
And his philosophy. It's so cynical, but also terrifyingly plausible. He says the trick isn't just to buy idealists.
Right. It's to make them an offer they would mistake for a victory.
Exactly. He takes their passion, their idealism, and just twists it, turns their very existence, their sustainable farming dream, into a tool for his own secret agenda. He understands their desires, their weaknesses, and uses that.
So Burnham Wood settles onto the farm. They start working. But that initial excitement, it just evaporates into paranoia pretty quickly.
You can feel it building.
Yeah. Shelley suspects Lemoyne is up to something much darker than just building a bunker. And meanwhile, Tony, off on his own, convinced Lemoyne is CIA or something even worse, starts his own sort of covert investigation,
yeah,
trying to dig up dirt.
And this is where Catton's narrative style is so clever, that roving consciousness the source material mentions.
Yes, it's crucial.
Because it lets us, the reader, know things the characters don't. That ramps up the tension, the dramatic irony. We find out Lemoyne's real motive. It's not a bunker at all.
No. He's illegally mining rare earth minerals.
Mm-hmm.
Hugely valuable, hugely profitable, and hugely destructive environmentally.
So Tony's paranoia, his sort of frantic digging, which everyone else dismisses as just him being difficult and ideologically extreme.
Turns out he was basically right all along. Not about the CIA, maybe, but about the core deception.
Yeah. And what's really chilling is how Lemoyne maintains control. How he stays one step ahead. It comes down to technology.
Exactly. This is where the surveillance capitalism theme really hits hard. Lemoyne uses drones, data mining. He's not just watching them physically. He's monitoring their emails, their messages. He knows their plans, their arguments, their relationships. He can predict their moves and manipulate them.
It's this cold, detached power. Technology as this amoral force that makes real opposition almost impossible. He uses data to shut down resistance before it even gets going.
And this whole spiral leads, inevitably perhaps, to the climax,
yeah,
which is sudden, brutal, and violent. Tony thinks he finally has the proof, the evidence of the illegal mining. He confronts Lemoyne directly on the property.
Which is just incredibly rash.
Totally ill-conceived.
Yeah.
And tragically predictable in hindsight. Lemoyne murders him, just like that. Silences him.
And the horror doesn't stop there. While Lemoyne is dealing with Tony's body, Sir Owen Darvish, the landowner, stumbles onto the scene.
Bad timing. Terrible timing. Lemoyne kills him too. Just cold, calculated disposal. There's no hesitation, no remorse shown. It's just problem solving for him.
And then the final awful twist. Mara arrives. She finally sees the full extent of it, the horror she's enabled.
And Lemoyne kills her too, eliminates the last witness who truly understands. Three people, all tied to the land, to the collective's original dream, just gone,
The ending is so chilling because it shows Lemoyne's complete control isn't just through violence, but through narrative. He uses all his resources, the money, the tech, the connections, to stage the scene.
Exactly. He creates a story for the police, makes it look like a murder-suicide, maybe some activist love triangle gone tragically wrong, something messy but ultimately simple.
The complex, ugly truth is completely erased, replaced by a believable lie.
And the novel ends with this deep sense of unease. Shelley's fate is left ambiguous, technically. But the feeling you're left with is overwhelming. Lemoyne won, completely. The ideals of Burnham Wood weren't just compromised, they were utterly extinguished, buried, literally, under the land they wanted to save.
It makes you think back to the title Burnham Wood, that allusion to Macbeth. It's there from the start, isn't it? Foreshadowing deception, things not being what they seem, a bloody end.
Absolutely.
Yes.
And the deep irony is that the gardeners themselves, moving onto the land to cultivate it, they literally become the camouflage, the moving woods that hide the forces of destruction Lemoyne represents.
It paints such a bleak picture of what the book calls capitalism as a devouring force. Lemoyne doesn't just defeat the opposition.
No, he absorbs it, consumes it. He uses their own language, sustainability, environmentalism, all the right words, as a mask for pure extraction. The novel seems to argue that this kind of power today doesn't just crush resistance. It integrates it, uses it, turns activists into, well, accidental accomplices.
Which brings us back to that central conflict. Ideological purity versus pragmatism. Tony versus Mira. And the novel is brutal about it.
It really is. Both paths end in failure and death when faced with someone like Lemoyne. Tony's rigid purity makes him ineffective and ultimately gets him killed. Mira's willingness to compromise, her pragmatism, leads straight to corruption and death. Catton seems to show that neither approach, on its own, is enough to win against these massive amoral forces.
Yeah, it leaves you feeling pretty pessimistic. There's that line you mentioned earlier, money doesn't just talk, it rewrites the conversation entirely.
Exactly. It captures that power imbalance perfectly. It's not a negotiation. The novel really makes you question how effective grassroots movements can be against that kind of entrenched wealth and surveillance power.
So the novel feels like this really urgent warning then, especially now with the climate crisis, with ubiquitous tech surveillance. The most dangerous lies might be the ones that sound closest to the truths we want to believe.
Yeah, it forces you to confront how fragile maybe our own ideals are, how willing we might be to compromise when offered something that looks like a shortcut.
Ultimately, it suggests that maybe good intentions aren't enough. Relying on the systems you want to change, well, it's a dangerous game. Power dictates the narrative.
A powerful and deeply unsettling read.
This conversation ends here. We'll meet again with another unique work of world literature. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.